This is The View from Tab. I'm Jim Menick.
I'm John Cruz.
I'm Mike Beats.
And we're going to start off tonight. We had talked about doing some more on public forum, and I think we're sort of run out of gas on it as a general topic. Before we say we've run out of gas completely, there are comments. And if you are still interested in this subject, go to the comments. Let's have the discussion there. I think that is a good place to do it. But on the other hand, we do have
one last issue.
I
have to jump in. I can't help this. Okay. Look. This is what I thought of when I read the public forum debate topic for the NCFL Nationals. There's this series of reviews on YouTube.
Well, what is it first?
Okay, let me read you the exact wording of this topic. Okay? Here's the topic. Boop-a-doop-a-doo. Okay.
That's an interesting.
The topic is resolved that the constitutional right of freedom of religion has wrongly evolved into freedom from religion. Now, there's this YouTube channel called Red Letter Media that has unbelievably funny film reviews of like nerdy films. Menick and I have shared a good laugh or two of these, including these reviews that just tear apart the Star Wars prequels. And those of you who know me know that I love Star Wars. But there's this critic on it who just says things like, Star Wars Episode II is the worst thing ever invented by a human after bagpipes. And that's the only voice I could hear in my head when I read this topic. So I'm going to have to do my tribute to Red Letter Media. This topic is the worst debate topic ever chosen. Okay? Look, this topic is wrong on so many levels. Let's forget about the word. Let's forget about all these like little picky things people are talking about the topic, about how they don't like this word or that word. How on earth could anyone feel comfortable debating this topic at the National Catholic Forensic League? I just don't see how anyone could possibly think that this is a fair topic to debate in front of this kind of an audience. And before anyone accuses me of saying that certain judges are not impartial, blah, blah, that is actually what I'm saying. Certain judges are not impartial. They're very partial, particularly in a field where the belief is that you don't need to have particularly trained judges. This seems to me a recipe for disaster.
I wrote this up.
Teams that were competing on this topic, you know, people complain about topics all the time, and I always say how it's silly. This topic is not a topic that I would ever feel comfortable debating.
I wrote this up. I'm going to read my own stuff. I love reading my own stuff. I love a resolution of dubious fact modified by a judgment of wrongly. While the line of history from the Constitution through to the latest declaration on the subject from SCOTUS is an interesting narrative, one must in this instance contend with a possibly false premise leading to a moral judgment and argued potentially in front of panels who have already accepted the premise and drawn a deeply held religious conclusion from it. Either you argue that it hasn't happened or it isn't wrong. With Beats, by the way. I don't know why I say that. But that was about something else altogether. Anyhow, says, by the way, a word to the wise, Flip Pro. Oh, wait, it's cat nats, no Flip. Okay, a different word to the wise, skip your con rounds unless your opponents are raving lunatics.
Yeah, this has got to be the all-time worst topic. I'm sorry. And, you know, I'm sure somebody has listened to this and is offended. And you know what? It just is the worst topic. I mean,
To run a religious topic at a religious tournament that is, in fact, open to people who are not a member of that religion.
How about the NCFL?
Well, God is the corporate sponsor of this.
This is the worst topic ever. I'm starting to sound like a right wing media person on the talk radio, yelling into the phone. But this thing is really like
We're gonna call you Cruz Beck.
Cruise back, right? Seriously, how could it? It's just driving me crazy. I really, look, I understand that different leagues value transparency in different ways, but I really want to know how this topic was chosen. I just do, and I don't understand how it could have been chosen. And I wouldn't feel comfortable debating it. And I don't feel bad saying it. I mean, I've made jokes about NCFL topics before. We all have. There are a lot of times they seem to be like rehashed topics with more confusing wording from old NFL topics. But this topic just really is not a topic I'd ever feel comfortable debating in front of. And that's all I have to say about that.
Well, substance, I mean, isn't it the right to freedom of religion, not of freedom of religion?
Congress,
I mean,
shall make no law respecting an establishment or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. That's okay. It. So wow. There is nothing else except for the, you know, the laws that have been come up since then. And the latest thing, essentially, I mean, there is a certain point.
There is no freedom of religion. It is a freedom from religion. I mean, that's what that...
Freedom from a religion, from a state-sponsored religion.
Right, they won't sponsor a religion or bar you from practicing yours.
Yes, so...
That's why this topic is A, offensive... In my
it's
mind,
just wrong. There is
wrong.
No constitutional right
it's,
of freedom.
It's something where you're playing into things that people have prejudged. I'm sorry. I just can't see how this topic could ever become. Okay, the tournament has a mass. It has a tournament mass on Saturday night. How could you feel comfortable with debating this topic? Won't this make a lot of people just really uncomfortable? I don't know.
Well, like, it's just people have already made up. There is a thing where the Supreme Court has essentially said, that it's our, I mean, yeah, because we have a lot of God in the government, you know, in God we trust, and they have, you know, opening prayers and all this kind of stuff at a lot of official things. And the Supreme Court has pretty much come out and said the reason that this is okay is because it's meaningless. Okay. That is not really a measure of, I mean, it's more like we just say it. I mean, they pretty much said that. So, you know, that it's not meant as a true religious declaration. So, I mean, I can see in, to a degree where this might come from, and people being upset
it comes from
that
Bill
this
O'Reilly.
People are upset that the government in fact doesn't stand for religion, that the government doesn't believe in God, that the government is agnostic.
Let's have a topic about Barack Obama's citizenship. I think that would be a great topic too, because that's what people talk about on television.
You should have a topic,
topic
on
really,
have a topic
you know,
on abortion.
Stinks.
You know, I mean, let's go for it.
Right, exactly. I mean. What makes me look, now I know I'm conflating different groups, but what makes me laugh is that in the past, I've been told that we will never have a gay marriage topic or an abortion topic because certain people, i.e. those who are against these things, would find it too offensive to talk about and too inappropriate for students to talk about. But it seems to me that this topic might offend a lot of people on the other side of the political spectrum, but it's being it's being debated and around. I don't know. It's weird to me.
But if you wish to be free from religion, that's wrong. So anybody who, in fact, who is not a believer is not only going to lose the debate, but is also going to be a wrong person.
And go to hell.
Yeah, you're going to go to hell. And you're going to go to hell that weekend. It is in Omaha. Let's keep that. Well,
okay, with all due respect to Fred Robertson.
I love Fred Robertson, but I don't like Omaha.
Some other quick thing here. Hating this topic does not mean you hate the people who run the tournament. It doesn't mean you hate anything else. I mean, you might dislike the tournament itself, but it doesn't mean anything other than disliking this tournament.
Yeah, it's not an indictment
I
of
hate
the,
this topic.
The management of CFL, believe me, we've done it here in New York. I've seen other people do it. More power to all you guys, but that's a different thing than picking the topic. This is whoever picked this topic. What were you thinking?
Yeah.
Okay. Anyhow, that's how we are putting to bed the whole public forum discussion here. And feel free to disagree with us.
I have another thing to say. I know I'm tired of talking about public.
Yeah, that was what I was agreeing with you about when it says on with Beats. It's enough of PF, but we've already talked for 10 minutes and it's nothing but PF. Okay.
But earlier, a friend of mine suggested that the way to save public forum from becoming Lincoln Douglas or policy debate or fast is to say, to tell the judges, make an explicit rule that says dropped arguments don't matter.
Right. Okay. So,
but they don't.
No, because because in policy and LD debate there is this unwritten rule, right, that all judges accept that if you drop an argument,
it's gone. Yeah, it's conceded.
It's conceded, and the opponent can win off, and your opponent can win off that argument. It becomes a potentially winning argument.
If in fact it is a winning argument, but yeah, I mean there are some people who do it so blindly that any drop that gets picked up is Right. That gets extended as a win. So yeah, I see what you mean.
But what if you took away that element and explicitly said, dropped arguments don't matter?
I mean, theoretically, they can't because, I mean, we are going to narrow, as the times narrow, to focus on, you know, one or two at most, one probably.
But wouldn't it necessarily then become a – it would become a persuasion activity. Like, in, I mean, and this individual said that that they shouldn't even host it at debate tournaments. It should be at speech tournaments. Like, if they have separate speech and debate, like in Minnesota, where debate is one semester.
Yeah, well, as Chris was saying, I mean, it's popular in Massachusetts because so many speech programs were doing it. And now it tends to be in both, but you can have it as one or the
other. Well, I think that what's interesting about this whole proposal is that public forum already seems to have a I'm trying to think of what it's not, but it has like a cluster of coaches who already strongly disagree with that, right? I mean, so what do you do with that?
But what if the NFL tournament said, what if the NFL rules said dropped arguments ought not, or dropped arguments, you know, the language would just be that dropped arguments don't matter.
Oh, I disagree with you. I'm just curious who would be on the committee, blah, 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 blah.
But yeah, but what you said, John, that's true of LD. We got plenty of coaches who don't like what's going on with LD, and they don't, you know, have that much of an effect, or they do, depending. I mean, there's no, you know, just because a bunch of people wouldn't like it doesn't make it a bad idea and doesn't mean that it won't happen or couldn't happen.
That's true.
I mean, I don't know how you make it happen. I mean, I don't know what the mechanism is for something like that.
I just guess what I'm saying is that it would be interesting to create maybe a community. If you did a community straw poll, like who are the movers and shakers in the PF community right now in terms of coaches, I'd be interested to know how many of them feel that way and how many of them don't.
Certainly there are a high echelon of very winning, but I mean, from coaches, but from what I read in, I mean, what Scott one has said is that this is like the most popular debate activity there is, which makes me believe that maybe there's just an awful lot of people doing this at a very regular kind of level, quotidian level, that isn't so interested in big things as much as using it to teach, blah, blah, blah. They have it goes away. You know, so there may, in fact, be this broad base of people who, okay, it's this, fine, it's going to be that, fine, whatever, which means that the NFL, if it wished to take a leadership position, could do so, could enforce whatever it wants to enforce, which to some extent it has done already. You know, it doesn't do it as much as I would like to see it do it in some things, but I think it has sort of done it in PF, so it could continue to do it here. I mean, I would actually like a strong national leadership voice of an organization rather than a weak one. So, and I think we have a weak one.
Well, especially when it comes to a division like Public Forum that was created with a specific intent. I mean, this is supposed to be the money, the cash cow for the NFL, right? It's supposed to be the event that sponsors are going to want to sponsor, that new programs are going to want to do, that's going to eventually end up on television. I mean, you need to protect that, right?
Yeah,
you have to have special rules.
Right, that's a good point.
For that event, just like in football, you have special rules about how you can hit the quarterback because that is the cash cow. The other NFL, the National Football League.
Well, anyway, I don't know how far any of this goes, and whoever, if you're a mover or a shaker, feel free to move and shake and try to make some of this stuff happen, or tell us why we're crazy. I'm perfectly willing to hear that too, but I'd love to see some of this change. Okay, what was the topic tonight? Was
tricks and psych outs, right?
Yeah, something. I don't know what I called it.
Psych outs and
tricks
and psych outs.
The intangibles, I assume, is what you're also referring
okay.
To.
What exactly are you talking about? Tricks and psych outs. What do you mean?
I used to think that there was this that you could have this strategy in cross examination where, for example, after the 1AC, like when you're on the negative, after the 1AC, you stand up immediately and do your your speech so that the judge has no time to digest anything that the affirmative just said. So you just stand up right away and give your speech. But that also gives you time. That also gives time, since you're going to use all 4 or 5 minutes of your prep time before the second negative speech, for them to look down the flow and see all the things that were dropped in the 1AR. And that would, you know, that would give some advantage. And then also I think makes some sense too, because at this point, most people's 1N is completely pre-written between the cases and the dissads and the theory and the critiques. It's all written anyway, so there's no reason to use prep time before the first negative speech. And then when you're on the affirmative, you use all of your prep time before the 1AR in order to make sure that you don't drop anything or anything like that. But then from a psychological perspective, before the AR or before the 2AR, you immediately stand up and give your 2AR as soon as the negative is done speaking, because you can spend your entire time of the 2N writing out, or you know, writing your speech. You don't really need to flow the 2N, you just listen to what they say and make sure it all fits within your argument. But then you stand up right after the 2A, after the 2N is done, and just go immediately into your 2AR, so the judge doesn't even have time to think about what the 2AR just, or what the 2N said, and you can immediately put it all back.
It sounds reasonable, but will the lack of orthodoxy confuse the judge or put the judge in a defensive position? Say, well, this guy is not doing it the way I like it to be done, or what happened?
I don't know.
I think we just lost Cruz.
Well, bring him back on.
Where'd he go?
I don't know. I'm still recording. Bring him back on.
I'll bring him up. Let me get him back on here. Conference call. Cruz. I need that conference. Okay, start it up again. Hey. There we go.
Are we going to have a technical malfunction noise at that point?
We had a wardrobe dysfunction or whatever.
Anyway.
Please stand by.
All right, anyhow, I was just saying that to me, if in fact, is the judge going to react badly to this, because the judge might just be expecting certain things? And then all of a sudden see some other stuff and just be, you don't want to psych out the judge.
No, that's true.
On the other hand, I mean, there certainly is a logic. I mean, if you're not using the NR as prep time for the 2AR, you're seriously wasting your time. I mean, that's what you do for that 6 minutes, is get everything ready so that you don't have to spend a lot of time. I mean, most people, I don't think, spend too much time before the 2AR, do they? I mean, it's just, I always find that silly if somebody's spending a lot of time before a 2AR, because it's mostly over. So all you have to do now is hit one ball out of the park, or maybe two. You don't have to like run a whole game again. You know,
I agree. I think way too many debaters don't use enough prep time before the 1AR, and that kills them because they drop something. But they use way too much prep time before the 1N. Way too much. Like, leave themselves under 30 seconds. Yeah. And the 2N is the most difficult speech to give. By far, the most difficult speech to give. Because you have to anticipate so much of what's going to be done in the 2AR. Mm-hmm. You have to close those doors.
Yeah. Anyhow, okay, so yours, I think that, I don't know how anyone gets psyched out, though. That sounds more an interesting way of handling things than an actual trick. I want a trick. I want something evil and nasty.
Is Cruz on?
I'm here.
Yeah, he's there. You do a lot. Okay. You were known for your nasty and...
I was real. Right. During my very large national career as a debater, I was well known.
You were always pulling rabbits out of your hat.
What was Beats about to say?
That you said that Noah Grabowitz was
sure. Noah Grabowitz. I mean, I think that's why I was surprised, Jim, that you didn't immediately catch what I was saying. I mean, I think that's so much of a debate. I mean, here's what I really think about this whole thing. One of the bad tendencies that debaters have is and on some level, debate camp and certain and like online discussions about debate, the emphasis that, you know, things that these kinds of things place on the flow and whatnot, make people forget that debate is still like an oral communication exercise. And I don't mean like that means you have to sound pretty all the time. I mean that it is a game on some level. You know, it's a psychological thing. It's two people pitted against each other in a competitive atmosphere. So to pretend like it's just a sort of sterile flow match is a little ridiculous, right? So I think that understanding the psychology of your opponent is really important. Now, I don't know if that goes beyond Beats what you wanted to talk about, but I feel like that's very much in line, right? Like getting the audience to turn against the opponent is a good way of not only psyching out your opponent, but sort of psyching out your judge, right? Because when you expose, Doug Jeffers and I have talked about this year after year at VBI in a lecture that we give called In the Face of Nonsense, that when you're debating somebody who has a very convoluted position, you know, highly critical, confusing position, some judges feel like pressured to vote for it because they don't want to seem uncool or seem like they don't know what they're talking about. I mean, I think most people could agree that that's true of a lot of judges, right? But when you are able to expose the position for how silly it is in cross-examination and get the audience to laugh at the position, to turn against the position, that is the ultimate psych out on many levels, right? Because first off, it's going to make your opponent uncomfortable when people are laughing at him, but it's also going to make your judges it's going to make your judge feel uncomfortable voting for such a position now, because now they've realized that the cool way to vote would be to vote against the position that everyone finds silly. Stuff like that, I think, is really important. It's not directly related to the flow, but it's definitely related to the ethos that the debater is generating, if that makes any sense.
I agree with that.
I mean, I think that's super important. I'll tell you, the story I like to tell is that when Matt did A1 Harvard, I kept telling him the entire time, I said, if you make it to the final round of Harvard, you have to give a thank you speech. I said, this is the kind of tournament where you need to give a thank you speech. And I'll say this for the record right now, Jake Niebel and I had this discussion later on. That thank you speech was strategically brilliant, okay? And it's strategically brilliant for three reasons. First off, I mean, it was very genuine. So Matt really did agree that that's the kind of venue where you want to give a kind of thank you speech, and that formal things are good in debate, and that people don't thank people enough in debate, you know, because it's very cutthroat. So I think that people could see that Matt really meant what he was saying. But it was kind of funny, if you want to really talk about like psychological warfare or tricking people and whatnot, is that that thank you speech was going to be given whether or not Matt was affirming or negating. And Matt realized afterwards, he said, wait a second. So that means that if I affirmed and gave the speech, well, what happened was Matt negated. So I'll start with that. If I negate and give the speech, then Jake hasn't given a thank you speech. So I'm the only one who gave a thank you speech. And I guess that makes me look good if people care about the thank you speech. But if I affirm and give the speech, that means that if Jake wants to write a thank you speech, now he's going to have to do it, I guess, in his prep time. and what was funny was that I will admit I realized that ahead of time with the thank you speech. That was not the primary motive, but that was in the back of my mind. And what was funny was that this went unnoticed, where out of nowhere, Jake suddenly said, you're a real jerk to me in the middle of camp. It's like, I said, what are you talking about? He goes, I just figured it out. So I think little things like that can be fun. And I obviously like pomp and circumstance, so thank you speeches are always good. But I think little stuff like that is kind of fun and makes debate interesting.
Working the room is the most important thing you can do, and so few debaters do this. They don't attempt to make any empathetic connection with the judges or with their opponents, and this is extremely important. I mean, from the first day I started coaching, it was the number one thing is a judge adaptation, which doesn't necessarily mean changing everything you do for the judge, but being tuned in what this judge is thinking, watching the judge, watching the body language, watching things like are they still flowing and stuff like that. Are they enjoying what you're saying? Do they look bored? And some people can do this without thinking about it. I mean, it's like being a poker player, being able to read your other people at the table. You can do this or you can't. And people who can do this have such an advantage.
This is why I was mentioning Noah Grablitz in the email earlier. You know, so those mm-hmm. listeners who aren't into their debate history may not realize that Noah Grablitz, one of the top LDers, records-wise, certainly in the history of the event, was coached by Jim. I remember distinctly, I think Tommy Clancy would talk about this at camp, where he would mention that Noah moved a lot in rounds, like he would move up to the judges. And Tommy, when he was a little younger, I guess thought that was because Noah was trying to like amplify his voice, but then he realized that Noah was also looking at their flows to see what was like empty on their flows. And I think that's very clever.
Yes, Noah
actually
was doing that.
I think that's very, very clever. Mm-hmm. I also could think of, rhetorical flourishes in round that really throw your opponent off. Like two come to mind that I've never forgotten. One was something that Corbin Cass said to Jacob Levy in semis of the Glenbrooks. And Jacob ended up winning this round, but it was like a really weird round. And I thought something Corbin did in that round was very clever. Jacob ran this really, really bizarre, like I think Kafka-based case, as I remember. And And Corbin wouldn't call it his case. He kept saying, it's like, okay, in Jacob's thing, he kept referring to it that way. And it was like clearly annoying Jacob. And while Jacob did end up winning the round, I still think that it was like a very effective way of, you know, sort of belittling what he was doing and throwing him off his game. And an even better example of that is I seem to remember, although maybe I'm conflating or confusing who was involved, but another debater that the gym coach, Justin Becker, did this thing where somebody, what topic was this? I guess it was the environmental protection, economic development topic, that people were running cards by Michael Crichton, which is, you know, like the author of Jurassic Park. And a number of people were running this evidence because I guess he published something in like a semi-serious journal. And I remember Justin, I seem to remember judging this round where Justin said, look, wouldn't refer to it as the Crichton card. He was like, all right, well, now the author of Jurassic Park is saying blah, blah, blah. And, you know, stuff like this, again, throws off the opponent, annoys them, makes them feel silly. I think that's really smart. I think that's really good. And I think that there is a fine line between being rude to your opponent and
– But I think you open yourself up to it if you're going to be running Michael Crichton as an expert on something. I mean, the guy's a doctor or a screenwriter or a director. He is not an environmental expert. He did go to this Southeast Asia once, so that doesn't make him an expert. I'm thinking – so apparently my team is the evil doers here – but I have to admit there is one thing that we always came from for a period of time. I had a number of short debaters, and we had this thing where as they're standing next to their opponent, always take a little step forward so that their opponent is a little bit behind, and that so they wouldn't look so short. But this actually became sort of de rigueur because and when you said Noah would take the look, yeah, well, he's actually, I mean, I've played cards with him, you know, so I know. I mean, count the cards every 5 seconds, you know.
Right, I have to interrupt. I feel like Ryan Hamilton would have been a really good guest star for this topic. Ryan is another, I guess this is starting to turn into war stories, so I'll try to keep the war stories short. But Ryan, you know, I didn't really get the chance to see Ryan in Lincoln Douglas debate mode when he was in high school, but he sure tells a good story about some of his rounds. And I know that Ryan is, for those of you who don't know, is a rather outrageous character and was certainly an outrageous character when he debated and would do things like he'd be known to put his hand in his opponent's face during cross-ex. I do not recommend that. Saying things like, are you answering my question or giving a second constructive? But the famous line is that Ryan, I guess, was wearing a bolo tie or something like that in a round. He's from Nevada. He's allowed to do that. And Ryan made some comment to his, I guess it's after the round, so it's not really a psych out or trick out, but it's just funny, is that after beating his opponent, he turned to him and said, I just beat you, and then he pointed himself, wearing this. That's the funniest, that remains to me the absolute funniest thing I ever said in a debate round. Okay, I'm sorry.
Didn't he at one point in one round, his opponent was rambling on during cross-examination, so he took his flow and just, it was during cross-examination, and just lifted it up and covered his opponent's face with the flow.
I believe saying, excuse me, but that may have been an embellishment later on.
I mean, I have seen one person who did a full 360 and while at the end of it, just slapped their opponent in the face with their case. Yeah, so
I once coached a debater who punches opponent in the face, but I guess that's a little different. But
well, anyway. That goes. I don't think that's a psych out. I mean, that's like punch out, and that we don't have. That's really getting a little carried away. But I've seen it's the person who slapped the other person with their case, but just got so excited. I mean, he was notorious for getting excited, and then like I'm watching him, and then zoop, all the way around, and you know, and it was a girl too. So this guy hit this girl in the face with a case, which was sort of. That's good. That's a strategy. You know, that one's going to get you to TOC. So, but I mean, if we're talking about tricks that we would actually either condemn or accept, I mean, I would say anything that is going to get the make your opponent get your opponent point out your opponent did something that they shouldn't have done in such a way that it's going to work in your favor would seem to be a good thing. You know, so this whole like Crichton evidence thing, which you know, I mean, it's the author of Jurassic Park. I mean, you know, or putting down the Kafka stuff.
By people
you know?
Named Dumber, which yeah. is another favorite thing for people to make fun of. This evidence is appropriately named. I've heard that.
Yeah, but that's not. I mean, that's.
I know it's not really a trick or psych out, but it kind of. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the thing is that in a world of increasingly flow oriented like obsessed with the flow kind of stuff, that when you do little things like that, it really does actually throw your opponent off the game. That's what I think. Mm. I think people get so hyped up about line by line argumentation that, and I don't just mean this in the debate sense, the bigger picture, but they really are missing the bigger picture, right? I mean, most debaters who compete at the highest levels consistently and are like really incredibly good debaters get the sense that debate is also about generating ethos, right? It's about being persuasive, even if, and I don't necessarily mean, again, in the classical sense of being persuasive, although a lot of top debaters are able to adapt to those kinds of judges, but that's a topic for another day, I guess. But I think that, you know, doing little things like that is a way of throwing.
We talk about just looking confident, you know, walking into a room like a schmo and walking into the room like a winner. I mean, things like that. I mean, there is a big difference between, especially if you're going to be debating somebody you know is going to beat the crap out of you, walking in there as if they've already beaten the crap out of you. I mean, I have seen, this is the, I mean, talk about psyching out. I mean, we've all had debaters who are extraordinarily good. Or, you know, we've all had our people go up against debaters who are extraordinarily good. So we've been on both sides of this. And the other debater, their opponents who psyched themselves out before they've even, before they, I mean, they look at the schematic and they've lost.
Yeah,
and
I agree.
That is just the most amazing thing to me, because I've never, ever, ever, ever seen a debater who couldn't be beaten. Every debater loses because sometimes they just stumble, they make a mistake. Maybe you are better than they are. You know, a lot of younger debaters going up against older debaters, you know, all of a sudden come into their own in those situations. So to go into a round saying, I'm going to lose this round, is absolutely the stupidest thing you can do, because you're not guaranteed to lose the round unless you go into the round saying, I'm going to lose this round, in which case you pretty much have sealed your fate.
Yeah, I agree completely.
Yeah, so working on confidence and feeling confident, because it's sort of like if you look like you're happy, you sort of get happier. If you look like you're confident, you get more confident, things like that. I mean, there is a connection between, there actually is a connection between smiling and being happy. Even if it's a false smile. But I mean, you actually can control yourself a little bit, and it's worth doing, because it's worse to psych yourself out than to get psyched out by the other person. If somebody else is playing games, as a general rule, you know, this is a bracketed tournament, you're probably playing some games too, and it's sort of fun. But if you don't even get to the level of playing the games, you just let that other person, you know, knock you out. I'm thinking of one thing. I love this one. This, speaking of stories, because this is a long time ago, and people didn't necessarily have everybody else's case so well. There wasn't so much
scouting. Oh, I know
what
you're going to say.
And everything.
I know exactly what story.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, so this was in the...
this is what I was thinking about. This is why I said...
But this, but the story is great.
You are the coach of this debater. How could you possibly...
Yeah, so, I mean, it was like it was going into the quarters round and at TOC. And, you know, you and he just said, you want my case? Here, have it. He just handed her the case. Here. And she was like shocked. Oh my God. And she took it and read the case and she beat him, which I thought was pretty good actually, you know, but I mean, it really did sort of take somebody aback. You know, you want the case, here it is. You know, I mean, it's not all about the case. I mean, this is one of the things everybody's, it is not all about the case. Yeah. There is something else going. Otherwise, you could just send in the cases, have the judge look at them and say, well, this is a better case. You know, there is more to it than the case or the positions. It's how it's done, what you choose, what you focus on, argument selection, blah, blah, blah. There's a hell of a lot more to it than just that basic stuff.
Execution in the round. I mean, you're... Yeah. That can vary from round to round, even from the same debater. You know?
Yeah, but we've said we're not... None of us are against disclosure, really, insofar as... Not all that much different. I hate to say it, folks, but most of your cases are exactly the same.
Yeah.
The little, 95% of the people are running the same evidence. If you're running, I mean, one of the things that I tell my kids, if you're running something radically different from everybody else, you're probably not on the right track. You know, I mean, everybody runs roughly the same stuff because there's a certain logic to running roughly the same stuff on a topic, because those are the main arguments that people have. You know, so if you're running something totally off the wall, that's probably you. You know, it's not really, oh my God, I'm more clever.
On some level.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think, even with like really hyper specific cases, I guess the examples themselves are different, but the actual argument that you're making really doesn't differ too much from one place to one place, right? Like, I mean,
there's a core of arguments that are meaningful, because most of these topics are classic, capital punishment. How many things could you possibly say? So you have a bunch of things and you say them. And, you know, so if you come up with something like totally unusual that no one else, I'm going to surprise everybody. No, you're really not. You're going to surprise yourself by how crappy you do. I mean, I've had debaters like that. They just think they're so clever. You're not. You know, if you're really clever, you would get past that fairly quickly. But I use that. I mean, that's one of my rules. You know?
Here are things that are bad tricks in psychouts, because these just make you look silly. People who think that opening with like a funny, irreverent quote is funny. Now, two things. I mean, a lot of people just don't open with opening quotes anymore. So
that used to be all the rage back in the day. Everybody, there's a reason for that too. That is, and
I mean, good people can disagree on this, but I sort of find opening quotes to be really, really, really not persuasive.
They're not. They're not intended to be persuasive.
I mean, I guess it's now old school to have a thesis at the top of your case. That I do find pretty compelling.
Here's the thing. It has nothing to do with what the content is, but it has to do with if you're going to speak any kind of public speaking, and this is part of judge persuasion or persuading your audience, there's two things you need to do with your opening. First of all, you want to grab their attention. Yeah. And second of all, you want them to be able to hear you and to understand what you're saying. So if you start talking, if you start giving a speech, as a general rule, it takes a while for the audience to get into your cadence and rhythm and stuff like that. So you say something relatively meaningless. This is why we never flow the quote or something like that. Okay. But it gave the person time listening a minute to get into your flow of your speed, and so forth and so on, the sound of your voice. I mean, let's put it this way. If you're judging, there are plenty of people I've judged who might have some kind of accent or something like that. Now, if somebody has an accent, it takes you a little longer to, adjust, calibrate your ears to hear clearly what they're saying. And if somebody like goes, blah, blah, and they have an accent on top of it, I mean, that's very counterproductive. But give me a second to see, they're going to talk. Okay, fine, good. Then I'm ready to go. So there is a technical thing, which is why, and all the speech clubs of taste makers or whatever, the Toastmasters.
Taste makers.
Toastmasters. Same thing. They talk. No. I mean, this is why, when you go and be these crappy speeches that all start with a joke or something. But look at all the other speech activities, I mean, not so much anymore, but Extemp had the same thing where you started with a little quote, a little story or something like that. I mean, part of it is persuasion and part of it is making some kind of, connection before you get into the dirt. And the other thing is just getting the person used to listening to you. So all the speech, not all, but a lot of the speech activities have this sort of built into them. And OO has it built in, and it's built in for a technical reason beyond just the thematic reason of this is that part of the speech and it's going to do this, that, or the other thing. So. Yeah, there is when I started in the 90s, everybody started with a quote, and now nobody starts with a quote, which is fine, but because quotes were content free for all practical purposes, but now we need something there just to if you just dive right in, it's like holy jeez, it takes a second. I just sat down, I just got here, so pull the people in. If you're going to go as fast as hell. You got to start the horse from a stop.
Really fast, like lose their ability to speak fast very, very quickly, which is why if you watch really high-level debates, the debaters tend not to start at absolute top speed, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's sort of something they're building into. That's how most people are able to speak quickly. I guess I can't speak for everyone, but that seems to be a good general rule of thumb.
Well, yeah, you definitely want to ramp up your pace. I mean, some rules of thumb about fast speaking is you want to, start slow and ramp up. Always slow down for when you're reading stuff that you want the judge to get down on their flow. So you want to slow down during those parts. Also, I think that one thing that debaters don't necessarily do because they think they have to go so fast is you don't necessarily want to have an opening quote, but you should certainly start with rebuttals, framing.
Absolutely.
Giving some big picture story about how everything is tying together and to frame or couch through how the rest of the rebuttal is going to go. Oh, I mean, definitely. I call it a shock and awe strategy where you go and make some big positional argument first against your opponent that throws their complete position off and then go through and do the line by line. But if they can't overcome that positional argument, they'll lose.
Yeah, I hear that position, and then everything else is in aid of it or not in aid of it, and everything else has to come to it from the other side. So making the statement, the overviews. I mean, that's another thing that's not all that old. Overviews never really happened. Overviews started, you know, maybe a little more than 10 years ago. And I think they're a good thing. And that's the same thing you're talking about, which is like, here's what we're talking about here. And then I say, okay, fine. And then if and it better be what we're talking about, but assuming that it is, and then you just provide the evidence to show why that's what we're talking about. I like the focus. I like having it focused.
So. Final focus?
No.
Ooh.
I'm just going to do PF from now on. All the even work, you know, just because I like doing it.
The Grand Crossfire?
Yeah.
I once proposed the Stupendous Crossfire, in which the judges also get involved, and no fewer than 3 representatives from the tabulation room. That's my preference.
Whenever I hear Grand Crossfire, I think of the Ku Klux Klan. I think, to me, it sounds like the Grand Wizard. It's the Grand Wizard Crossfire. Right. It has the words, it has crossfire and it has grand in it.
It's crossfire as one word, not 2 words. But I mean, we could do that as your next April Fool's thing. You know, well, from now on, only the Ku Klux Klan would be allowed to judge, you know, in robes.
On your blog, POFO needs to be changed to crossfire.
Ooh, is its code term? I like that.
Jeez. Okay, so what are some other tricks and psych outs that we seem to be more talking about just more subtle things that people should be doing more than
Adam Porcel said that he used to in cross examine. A lot of these can take place in cross examination.
Oh, because definitely. That's why I would never. That's why I actually have to say that. As much as I think that idea is cool to like go right into the speech, I think cross ex is like the. In many ways, it's the most important. I mean, there are a lot of reasons why I still think it's the most important part of the round, and I think if more debaters realized that, they would be taking advantage.
This is where personality comes out. This is where absolutely. I, as the debater, get to connect with the judge straight on as compared to just reading a case or something like that. You get to see the personality in action. This is where speaker points come from. I mean, I think there's something, this is where they go away. You know, if somebody's really rude or nasty or something like that, it's hard to give somebody a 30 if they're really rude and nasty. You know, whereas, you know, if they're really sharp and they're smart and they answer everything and they're really leading, because if this is on their feet kind of stuff. Yeah. So, and the whole idea that I'm not going to have cross-ex, I'm just going to take, you know, 3 minutes more prep time or whatever it is, the flex prep or whatever the hell it is, just seems the dumbest thing in the world because you're giving up the opportunity to connect with your judge. I mean, all you're doing now is reading a bunch of evidence, which is...
It's a time where you can have an inside joke with the judge, right? Where if your opponent says something dumb, since you and your opponent aren't looking at each other, you can make some, you know, you can make a silly face at the judge and be like, what did they just say? Or something along those lines.
Gotta be careful with that. Gotta be real careful with that.
Adam Porcel said that he used to always, as soon as he finished answering a question, he would start talking some more so that when his opponent interrupted him, he could act all exacerbated.
Adam Porcel was also a power lifter, so I think that he's just psyching out his opponent by scaring the crap out of them. But anyway...
But it's cross-ex and the things that one can do. There's another thing, but this is not really cross-ex, but this is when you're debating somebody who's the absolute world's worst debater and where you can't do any of that stuff. When somebody is the world's worst debater, especially if you have a good judge, and everybody knows, and everybody in the room knows it's the world's worst debater, and you can really screw yourself over by not treating them like the best debater. I mean, you have to treat them with so much respect and help them out and make their arguments for them and finish things. And I think what my opponent is going for here is this. And that doesn't really work because as compared to, that's the dumbest ass thing I ever heard, you schmuck. And this is how you get 30s, by being civilized and being, a good person. Which we don't ordinarily need all that much. But sometimes, especially in those random rounds, you're hitting somebody. You know, like if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably a fairly decent debater. And you're going to hit these people that aren't that good. And you don't run them over. You don't steamroll them. You know, make them look good.
On the other hand, knocking down somebody who is perceived to be way stronger than you, standing up to that person can give you a lot of credit as well. Mm-hmm. I can think of – I can't remember the exact details of this. Well, I remember the debater was Mike Baer, who was a really underrated debater from Walt Whitman. This was pre-Anjan, pre-even Ryan Hamilton Walt Whitman. And Mike Baer was really good. I think he was a really underrated debater. And he was had a very good like style in rounds for doing stuff like this, especially when he was debating debaters who were perceived to be like stronger than him, either regionally or nationally. And I remember one time he pointed out that this debater, like, I guess this debater was running like a really deontological, like a Kantian framework. And it was just totally wrong what he was talking about with Kant. I mean, it was like totally misconstrued, but nobody was calling on it him on it, right? Because I guess they were intimidated or whatnot. And he really went toe-to-toe with him. And then I remember the last thing he said was, he's like, you know, he's just totally showing why this Kant stuff is incorrect. And the very last thing, Mike Baer is negating, right? So he ended his 2 hours going, look, remember, my opponent's getting this all wrong. So for all these reasons, you Kant affirm. And I thought that was like, I mean, that's so dumb, but it's so funny.
Yeah, it's funny. Dumb I mean, can be funny.
Saying that just, you know, again, when you're in a situation where it's like you're supposed to be the weaker debater in this round, quote unquote, I think that that's pretty awesome, actually. Those reasons you can't affirm.
Well, like I said, those weak debaters have become strong debaters, and
yeah, exactly.
There is. I mean, I have a theory that that everybody has about 3 years of debate in them. So people start as freshmen, and then junior. The best debaters sometimes seem to be juniors. I don't know. In their third year, and then they get like so into other stuff because they're starting to worry about school and everything like that. And then the next ones, and so it's like they're going to the elephant's graveyard kind of thing. And it's not true all the time. I think it's true to some extent. The seniors don't last the whole year, and they are vulnerable. I just say that. Just saying. Mm-hmm.
I think that's true with a lot of seniors. I think, dude, that is actually true with a lot of seniors. I don't know if that's
true. It's not true of all of them. I've seen some that aren't like that.
Highest caliber debaters, but I do think that that's actually probably pretty true in terms of
Yeah, on the other hand, experience is good for a lot of stuff. If you're a debater for 4 years and, you know, a hot shot comes along, your experience sometimes can really put out a younger hot shot just because you know what to do because you've been there, done that. You're probably being out-debated left or right, but you know how to win the round because you've just debated 10,000 rounds and they've only debated 100 rounds or whatever the case may be. And there's these little, I mean, they're truisms, but they're not, you know, 100% accurate. They're stereotypes more than anything else. But I mean, I think there's some truth to some of those things. It's something to keep an eye on when you're debating, you know, who are you debating? What are you up against? The judges too. I talk about the judges. We talk about playing the judges.
Yeah.
Playing the judges on Friday is a lot different than playing the judges on Saturday. You know, after the judge has already judged about 50 rounds, it is a different person than that judge was a day ago. And a lot of debaters don't help out those judges at all. This is why in break rounds, debaters who are more entertaining tend to do fairly well because the judges are just damn tired. I mean, they've judged almost every round, if not every round. And they've done double flights when the debaters have all done single flights. So the judges are pooped. And you got to help them out here a little more, even though, yeah, they're great judges, whatever. They're tired. They don't want to be here. So make it nice for them. You know, play to that point that they're tired. Don't make them work hard. Do that work. Of course, we do that all the time. Do the work for the judge. Don't make them do the work.
I agree.
So is there anything that we've missed? Because we're getting near the magic hour before Chris calls us up and says, here I am. Here I am. No. You know, since I had no tricks or psych outs of my own, we never used them on my team.
Yeah, right.
I can't speak to this.
I feel like there's a place for a good John and Jed story here, Beats. I'm getting a little, or Nick's story. I'm getting a little.
No, the only trick that we ever did was when I flipped.
I know that story. That's the best.
What is this?
Oh, this is so good.
It was the. It was the finals of the Green Hill Round Robin, and we got to call the flip because I guess it was because it was against Sam Doobie, a Green Hill debater. And so when Aaron Timmons flips the coin, I yell out, negative.
All right. On that note.
Well, we flipped neg. I actually don't remember how it ended up. I don't remember at what side.
Right. All right. You
should get Sam on to talk about extending opening quotes.
Opening quotes, yeah.
There are people that do extend opening quotes. I mean, we kind of did a trick this weekend at NFL. I mean, we ran for people that didn't read full source sites, we had the NFL manual there. We had a full We had a full theory violation, and we used it.
That's pretty impressive that you have judges who would even be open to such an argument like that at your district tournament. I'm
it's
gonna
the
say.
Rule. How else can
I,
we?
I rule. Believe me. I printed up
he
the rules and gave them to my
about
debaters.
Making that kind of argument before, and I'm not really that into theory arguments, but I was sort of into that.
We also argued against someone that was using a computer. We ran theory against them. And then I found out afterwards that we didn't actually have to run theory against them. And even if we would have lost the round, they would have been disqualified from the tournament anyway.
All right. I'm sure that was the intent behind the rule, was for people to run a theory violation about the computer.
We did it. I mean, we said, look,
there's nothing wrong with that.
We normally use computers in rounds, but we chose to respect the rules of this tournament. They should too.
I don't disagree with you.
Well, the rule about evidence is just that they have to the first time a piece of evidence is said, you have to say the source of the evidence. So we said that if the opponent wants to spend all of their 1 AR reading the sources, that's fine too.
You talk about no, seriously though. I mean, people that throw out evidence without telling you where the evidence is from. I mean, this is just such sloppy debate, and that's the accepted norm is Joe Blow, blah 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 blah.
I disagree with that. I think there has to. I think you have to read the publication and you have to read the date, especially on this topic. I know that Eric Legreed from Blake is carrying a theory file that's about reading dates, because on this topic, so much of what we're evaluating is empirical and timely. I mean, the type of sanction that's being used is important, and knowing when a specific article was written is important too. I mean, you can't evaluate sanctions from an evaluation of sanctions from 1993 as you would in 2010. Yeah. And so, he's arguing that the opponent needs to read the dates, or that you are responsible for reading dates in the debate round. Because it wastes the time of it wastes your time to have to go through all their evidence and ask what date is this from, what date is it from, when they should have done it in the first place.
I mean, that's just the normal. I mean, if you're writing a paper of any sort, you give the who wrote it, where it's from, when they wrote it. There's no big deal, and only it's not like it's going to take any time to do it. But that's just the nature of presenting any kind of evidence, any kind of quotation from anything. Yeah, it's just not asking a lot.
Yeah, I agree.
All right.
You probably think they should read the entire MLA citation, though.
Let's not get carried away. Okay, it's the clock on the wall says that I'm.
It's time to quit.
Yeah, it's time to quit. All right. And all right, so it's time to quit. I will see you guys next week.
Bye.
See you next week. Bye bye.